I like your seal.
That's mine.
Can I touch it?
The Christian Bale and McKenna Grace love seals.
Oh yeah?
Thank you.
So how is your story with animals? So I'm a tattoo seal, so how about you?
Oh, which my favorite animal, or?
Favorite animal. Do you have any life experience with any animals?
I'd like to meet a Wolverine, but I haven't yet. I've seen a video of a guy who has one, though, that they're training to find people after avalanches.
Oh my God.
Because I guess they have really, really good noses. And so they have one, I saw, I think on National Geographic or something, this guy has a Wolverine, they're training to find people. I don't know, like, people would be surprised if they were buried that a Wolverine would be the thing that finds them. It would probably be very exciting for them in some ways.
Hey Chris, why did you choose The Call of the Wild to be your first debut as a live action movie for you?
Because there's such a huge animated element to this. I knew that the animated component is something that I'd be relatively familiar with. So that made me feel like, okay, I know that I can handle that part of it, and I think the rest of it I can learn.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Great movie. We love
it. You guys were just talking to Harrison, right?
Yes.
Wasn't he amazing?
Yes.
He's great, right?
So what made you select him?
I was just telling Erwin, I said selecting Harrison was easy because one day Erwin called and said, how about Harrison Ford? I said, that's great. Like, so I didn't have anything to do with it. Erwin, I don't know how he got the idea, but yeah, he presented me with the idea, which I thought was swell. And next thing I knew, I went over to Harrison's house with Steve Asbell, and we were just pitching him how we were intending to make the film. And one of Harrison's first questions was like, how would we be dealing with a dog that wouldn't be there and would be added later? And that part of it, I was also learning. I knew that we were going to have a stand-in for Buck, whether it be a little stuffed model, which they call a stuffy. But most of the time, it was going to be a human being, Terry Notary, and he had been doing that kind of work before. So Terry would be standing in for Buck. And so not only was Terry there for us to be able to know where the dog would be, and we could track, you know, a shot and have a space that was, you know, properly framed, but the thing that was really fantastic about it that I didn't really think about in the beginning was that Terry allowed us to talk to Buck and to develop a scene. Before you shoot a scene, you always sit down and talk about it. And so we could actually sit down and Harrison and Terry could confer about how they wanted the scene to work, and then it would happen. So when I went later on to the animators we had on film, and also because I was there and remembered what we talked about, we could talk to the animators about what the intention was for Buck's performance. So it was a new thing that nobody who's ever done Call of the Wild has been able to do before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Payment treats?
Well, your donuts are always available.
One of the things that I really liked about this adaptation was the fact that we didn't see any on-screen deaths of the animals, or seeing them get, I mean, we see the shadow of them Buck getting beaten, but we don't see it on screen. What was your intention with that?
That was one of the most important things to beginning the project, was me being able to guarantee Fox that we could do this novel in a family-friendly way. Mm-hmm. For a broad audience. And because I come from animation, from Disney Animation and from DreamWorks, that's something that's second nature to me. So I knew that no matter what was in the novel, we could adapt it. And that was one of the very first things we talked about, was the scene with Red Sweater and how we would do that. And I said, well, at that critical moment, we'll do that with a shadow on the wall, mm-hmm. so that we know what happened, but nobody ever had to really, you know, full on see it.
That was my wife's comment going in, was, I really don't want to see that dog get beaten. The book, for the last 100 years, when I was a kid, it was recommended, it was on the reading list for 4th, 5th, 6th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And now Common Sense Media recommends 13, 14 and up.
My daughter just read it, and she was about 13 when she read it.
Yeah. But it feels like what I got from the film was, this is kind of your attempt to bring the story back to its original target audience in a way that modern children are comfortable with. as opposed to...
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing that I do is try to find a finished product that anybody of any age will get something out of. That it's speaking on multiple levels all at the same time. So adults can go see this film and they'll see certain things that a kid may not see for a few years until they get a little bit older as well. Yeah, absolutely.
So I read somewhere that this type of dog is no longer around. Is that true? Or I mean, what kind of dog and how did you determine the look?
Oh, interesting. So every dog in the film has a real live-action counterpart. The reason we did that was that two reasons. It shortcut the building process for the dogs, but it also gave them believability. Mm-hmm. Building a dog from scratch to be photoreal, you're never going to get it quite right. There's going to be something about it that may make you uncomfortable. So every dog has a real-life counterpart. Buck, the lead dog, he was the only one that we didn't have. Because Jack London very clearly described him as a mix of two breeds, Saint Bernard and a farm shepherd. We didn't have one of those. And early on we thought, well, what about a Bernese Mountain Dog? They're very dramatic, they're very beautiful, they're certainly very robust and stuff. And so that's how we began. But even though we started with a Bernese Mountain Dog as a model, we still wanted to build him from scratch. I wanted to build him from scratch because I wanted him to have certain traits. That wasn't working out. It was October, and we had a Bernese Mountain Dog on set as color reference. And anything that you see, in fact, if you look very carefully in Thornton's cabin on the back wall, is a drawing of a Bernese Mountain Dog, because that was the intent, was that he was sketching Buck. But because those dogs are so predominantly black, I began to get really concerned about how many shots we have at night and how well that dog would read. Then my wife in October was looking through Pet Finder, and she said, "You'll never guess what. I found a dog that was found as a stray wandering the streets of Kansas, Emporia, Kansas, and he's the exact combination of breeds that Buck is." And the weird thing was, he was listed on their website under the name Buckley. So she said, "I'm going to go." And she drove 2 days to Emporia, Kansas. She met Buckley. She bought him for $25, and because he was on special, because nobody was buying him, she drove back to set with Buckley, and she walked onto set with him, and immediately, I think everybody just said, "Let's make that be the dog." My wife's name is Jessica Steele Sanders, by the way, if you want to put that in there. And she said, everybody said, "Let's make that the dog." So we took Buckley to Gentle Giant, and we scanned him, and he's the lead. He lives with me. He's our dog. Whoops, hold on, sorry. Sorry for the code. Wait, I have to clear my messages. How do I do this? Make the messages go away. Okay. There we go. I'm not doing this right. Okay, ask me more questions, I'll figure this out.
As this was your first mostly live-action film, what was the biggest difficulty?
Oh, my God.
That's him.
Oh, yeah.
He named the same way?
Yeah, he's Buck. We just kept Buck. So he's Buck. Yeah.
So cute.
He was a rescue dog.
He's a rescue.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah.
Story.
That's more amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So he had his own sort of incredible
and
journey.
Amazing for your wife to go 2 days.
Yeah.
That's really awesome of her to do.
Yeah.
How's the behavior?
Oh, he's so sweet. He's a big baby. He's a big baby. And he really is. He's extremely young. We don't exactly know how old he is, but he's probably about 2 years old. At the time that we scanned him, he was about one. Yeah, and the only thing we had to change is that he was about 20 pounds underweight, and as we fed him and he got healthier, his tail got way fluffier. So I had to keep going back and changing the model to be bigger and fluffier.
Okay.
So finally, the buck in the movie, which is an exact duplicate of Buckley, he has the proper tail.
So what's special about working with Harrison Ford that it's different from everybody else that you work with?
Oh, golly. Harrison's Harrison. He's got an amazing presence. I mean, he's amazing on film, and he's amazing to meet. I think one of the great things about working with Harrison on this was that he developed that whole backstory of why in the world is he out in the Yukon in the first place? What is he running from? What happened to him? And what is his exact relationship with Buck? And so there was a certain amount that we had in the script, but there's a great deal that needed to be filled in and developed. And that was, I think, the neat thing about working with Harrison is watching his process of filling in that backstory and developing a character that's 100% believable and real, so that he knows from moment to moment how that character is going to react to any situation. And that for me was a bit of a revelation, because it's the first live action film I've ever done. And I've always read about actors working on their characters before they arrive to shoot. I'd never really seen it happen before. And now I get it. I get why you need to do that. I get how that process works. It was really neat. I mean, and the whole scene where he's writing that letter to his wife, I dictated that. I wrote it down. I did not dictate. He dictated it to me, and I simply wrote it down, and it stayed intact all the way through shooting. So he just, he had worked out that scene, and just, yeah.
Besides of the professional aspect of Harrison Ford, what did you kind of surprise, or what did you, surprise you that Harrison Ford himself, he's an environment activist, maybe he always pick up the plastic bottle or mm-hmm. nose throw or every evening he call his wife.
Yeah.
Something like that.
One of the things that his love of the natural world and his understanding of how important that whole thing is, the way that came out in the character was that the John Thornton in the novel is after gold. He even makes a wager as to whether or not Buck can pull an incredibly heavy sled, and that's the way he gets this the money he needs and the map that he needs to go and seek his fortune. And the Thornton in our movie is all about adventure and getting into wild places. In fact, there's a couple different places where people talk about finding gold, and he says, "I'm not in this for the gold." We wanted to stay true to the Thornton in the novel in that when he does get to the ramshackle lost cabin, he does find gold. He finds a fortune. But the way that he reacts to it, he certainly has a lot of fun finding it, but he mostly throws it all back. And that's something that that Harrison developed and brought to the party, which I thought was really, really sweet, that it was more about the trip than the destination.
As a former English teacher, and I taught this book in high school, I will say that was probably the backstory that fleshed out was probably my favorite part of the movie, one of them. So it was
great.
Lovely. And that only enriched the story more. My question for you is, what was the biggest difficulty between transitioning from animation to mostly live action?
I think it was the allure of live action to somebody who works in animation is the idea of the immediacy of it. Plus, I'm a big camera geek, so I just wanted to be, I love the idea of the equipment and the cameras and stuff like that. The trepidation that I had going into this was that in animation, you have almost unlimited time to make adjustments and changes. And you can make some very big last-minute course corrections in the story to perfect things. I was nervous about the idea of going onto a set, shooting something, moving on, and not getting to do it again. So my terror, and it kept me up at night, was the idea that I would shoot a scene, and then that night, or days and weeks later, realizing, oh no, I forgot something, really stayed with me. But all my producers said, don't worry, we are all there to make sure you do not forget anything. and then later on, the thing that was really fascinating was, in editorial, how many ways you can manipulate something to make it feel one way or the other. You have a huge amount of latitude that I didn't realize to change things and to adjust things and to shape the story just in editorial.
Did you do any storyboarding of your own? Or
to my surprise, yes. That was a big surprise of mine. I was sitting very early on, we wanted to do a demo reel of a scene or two from the movie to show Fox and show them the vibe of the film. And we hired story artists to come in and do this stuff. And at one point I said, well, I just want to do this and this and this and this and this. And I said that I was working with Glenn Derry, who ran a special effects house that we were working with. And I said, oh, just do you have a piece of paper? I think I'll just draw it. So he gave me a piece of paper, and I drew these panels the way I thought the scene should unfold. And he said, wait, you can do that? And I said, yeah, I come from story. I can storyboard. And he goes, why are you just doing that all the time? I said, you're right, maybe I should do it all the time. So I started storyboarding more and more stuff. The whole scene between Thornton and Buck, for example, at the end of the film, I boarded that shot for shot the way that I thought it should roll out. And so I did a lot of boarding throughout.
Why did you decide to shoot in Santa Clarita and not just go directly to Canada or in the winter?
Yeah, well, that was something, that was a big decision early on. That was like one of those live action things I didn't know about, because they were like, where we shoot this is going to be very important to us, that we want to make sure that we have a place that is financially advantageous for us to shoot it, which would be closer to home, but make sure that it doesn't give us any limitations. So they found a place, a movie ranch called Sable Ranch, where a lot of stuff is shot, and we actually built most of our sets at Sable Ranch, including the river, which we dug a river, filled it with rocks, set dressed it, and they brought in gigantic pumps that would move water at 30,000 gallons a minute, and we could actually throttle the river. So we could, if we thought the current was too strong, we could throttle back on it, or we could, we never really ever used the river at full throttle. We only had it ever, we had two of the three pumps engaged at any one time. But yeah, and I had the very same question. I'm like, well, there are already rivers. Shouldn't we just go to one? And they're like, this is way better. And I'm like, okay. And so once they dug it and they built it and filled it with water, I understood why it was better.
So it was deep because we see John bathing in it.
Yeah.
That's, wow.
Yeah. That's our little river.
Oh,
few,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
How about canoe
riffs? Yeah, we had a canoe that was built. We had a hero canoe that was built traditionally. It was a birch bark canoe that was 100% real. For all the hero shots, the close-up shots, we also had some stunt canoes, because the scene where a canoe goes over that waterfall, that's a real guy in a real canoe who made that incredible drop over that thing, and he did it successfully. I think he only did it once, because he got it right the first time. So we had some stunt canoes that were in some Canadian rivers that did all those rapid shots. We had a canoe that had some equipment on board that it had an inertial recorder. So every little thing the canoe did was recorded on this inertial recorder. So we sent the canoe down these different rapids and we filmed the canoe. The information from the inertial recorder was fed into some robotic machines that we had another canoe on. Then we shot Harrison in that canoe and it reproduced exactly what that canoe did in the river, so that we could take Harrison in that canoe and drop it into the river shot, where we had a stuntman who drove a canoe down the river and it fit in perfectly. It's pretty amazing.
So what about the snow? I mean, the scenarios in which there's a lot of snow, was it also computer generated?
It's a combination. Anything a human being touches is real, except for a dog. The dogs were all replaced. But walking on snow, the buildings, canoe, any of that stuff, the river, all that stuff was real stuff. The snow we would extend, every single set, it only had a certain amount of set that we built, and then we would extend it. So sometimes we would enhance the snow if we had some footprints in it that we might not want, but for the most part, all the snow that people are stepping on was the real snow that was there that day. We had ice trucks that came and constantly replenish the snow. We would take a break and they would blow snow onto the set and we would start shooting again. And that was the only mistake I made the first day shooting in Dawson. I wore my tennis shoes and I was standing on snow all day long, so my feet were freezing. So from that day on, I wore my snow boots every day.
Winter Wonderland.
One more,
yeah.
More
with all the advances in technology and, you know, the image capturing, motion capturing, and this being your kind of first live action, was there anything you were really surprised and just blown away by?
I was, the canoe thing I was blown away by, but I was also surprised how much stuff we wanted to do practically. Mm-hmm. And so there's a scene where Dan Stevens gets thrown out of a bar into the mm-hmm. snow, and I said, well, so how are we gonna do that? And they said, well, we're gonna throw him into the snow. I said, yeah, but how are we going to do it? And they're like, well, we're going to grab him, and we're going to throw him in the snow. And that happened a lot. I'm like, so how are we going to do the whole thing where the cabin collapses? It's like, well, we're going to pull the cabin down. So we have pins we're going to pull, and it's going to fall down. I was like, oh, so we're just going to do that. Like, so how's the guy going to... So if they throw you through a window, they're just going to throw you through a window, just to know. Yeah. It's it's going to happen. So
there's
a, yeah, the best stuff was in camera. Not the best stuff, but the easiest stuff was in camera. So we try to do as much stuff in camera as possible. And a lot of the stuff during the fire in the cabin, that was all practical. One of the nights we were shooting the burning cabin scene, they could burn the cabin repeatedly with these flame bars that they put into it, and the cabin was built in such a way that it would not just go up in flames. It was treated with flame retardant. It was real wood, but the wood was very resistant to burning. And one of the nights we were shooting, it was just so incredibly cold. Somebody said, "You want to go stand in the cabin?" And I said, "Like while it's burning?" They're like, "Yeah, come on in." So I just sat inside the cabin while we set up a shot as the cabin was just engulfed in flame. I was like, "It is nice in here."
All right, thank you guys.
Good question. Is